If you were at the installation, you might remember that the opening line of the choral piece that Ryan composed, it started with the words, "On the clock of the world, it's dark. Dawn is coming, and day's about to break." This lyric is a reference to a question from civil rights activist Grace Lee Boggs. Boggs died about a year ago now at the age of 100, but not before she managed to ask at least four different generations of young activists, "What time is it on the clock of the world?" Boggs's question invites us to engage with a global sense of time and to put the idea of something like revolution in a larger context. She wanted us to stretch our humanity so that we might better consider what's true about this moment, our current moment in history, in the context of the greater arc of the universe, an arc that is bigger than any of our lifetimes, certainly bigger than any one election, larger than any one country, including the United States of America. Her question wakes us up from our painfully short memories, our impossibly fast media cycles, and our lack of a sense of proportion to other times, and reminds us, no matter our catastrophizing about the current age, all times have their problems and their opportunities. All have their pressing moral questions, including our own. Thinking about time in this global way is a great antidote to the sort of stress that we just heard about, the sort of stress that I'm guessing many of us relate with. I mean, if you're willing, I'd just be interested how many of you relate with the story we just heard. Yeah, just those of you in the front, look around a little. Right, this is why actually we decided to hold, you'll see in the pink sheets, there's a, we're holding a moving through fear election processing time on this coming Thursday. You're all welcome. Regardless of your political party or ideology, it'll just be a time to try to hold and process some of that stress. This feeling that our political process, our democracy, perhaps our entire American experiment is facing a unique state of dysfunction or even collapse. This is so stressful. Stressful and depressing. Overwhelming, anxiety-producing, and as the reading described, this stress can make us avoidant, angry, reactive, afraid. Talk to most people today about politics, and they'll either sigh and ask you to change the subject, or list with anger all the ways that our democratic system has failed, and why, and who's to blame. Usually, it's someone out there, some stranger from the other side, or the media, or corporations, and big money, or politicians, or family values, or lack thereof. It is so stressful and anxiety-producing because we were taught to love our American story, our practice of democracy and embrace of liberty and justice for all. Seeing the reality of what today's politics looks like, at least according to our Facebook feeds, cable news, or even public radio or the New York Times, it is a constant experience of heartbreak. Which is why I must confess that while I've known about Parker Palmer's book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, for a few years, I have actively avoided it. Now, I am a fan of his work generally. I love his book on vocation called Let Your Life Speak. I even went to hear him speak at the University of Denver in 2008. He's one of those rare people who appears to be the same person in real life as he is on the page. Smart and thoughtful, hopeful, complex. But still, I saw this title come out and I was like, nope. Because I have heard all the chants at the rallies. I've seen the signs. I've read the posts on social media. And as we talked about last week, the comments section. I've watched the congressional feed from C-SPAN, heard the interviews on NPR. I saw his title about healing the heart of democracy and saw that it was about cultivating new habits in the heart in service of our common life. And all I could think was, what good would it do for our common life for me to practice new habits of the heart when it seems to me that those who think of me as other would prefer that I wasn't in common with them at all? I could have all the good intentions and practices in the world, but really, what good would it do? Holding this tension and heartbreak without turning away, it turns out, is one of the key healing habits Parker promotes, and what he describes as one of the main functions of democracy. In a democracy, he says, many, many things won't be resolved. And a path towards resolution may not even be clear or seem possible. Many things won't feel comfortable or fixed, often for entire lifetimes. There's Boggs's global sense of time again. Yet democracy requires people who will stay engaged and even hopeful and connected with others who are different than they are, even when it may not do any obvious good at all. Even when those others don't seem to want to be engaged with you. Democracy requires a faithfulness to our common humanity, which is a heart-based discipline where we refuse, in any case, to see any other human being as our enemy. Now, the heart isn't usually the first thing we associate with democracy. That fifth principle I was speaking about earlier in the chalice lighting, it's actually the ones that I would consider the most rationally and coolly stated: the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Now, I know I'm showing my generational bias, but honestly, these words call to mind long meetings held in school gyms during times when I have to work or pick up my kids. Meetings filled with folks who like to debate for hours, analyzing big ideas, maybe even more so than making those ideas a reality. But as I said in the chalice lighting, behind those potentially stuffy-sounding words, there are deeply held, emotionally charged beliefs and practices, or at least there needs to be. Beliefs and practices that have to do with our humanity, our personhood, and the quality and meaning of life on this planet, and our capacity to care for one another, that have to do with the heart. Parker reminds us that democracy isn't actually about some distant center of power, legislatures, lobbyists, party caucuses, and boardrooms, or even about school gyms and long meetings. The impulses that make democracy possible and those that threaten it, he says, originate in the heart. With its complex mix of heedless self-interest and yearning for community. From there, these impulses move out into our relations with each other in families, neighborhoods, workplaces, voluntary associations, and the various settings of life. Democracy depends on ordinary Americans energized rather than defeated by whatever breaks their hearts, taking step after small step in local settings to contribute to the common good. We, the people, not they, the people. We. Now, in the same ways that the term courageous love means something more than and different from romantic love, heart, as Parker Palmer uses it, isn't about a squishy, sappy place for simple emotionalism. Parker means heart in the same way that Alexis de Tocqueville talked about mores in his 19th century classic Democracy in America. It is a term that's meant to describe all the moral, intellectual, emotional, intuitive, imaginative, experiential, embodied, and relational habits of the person and society as they converge in one place we'll call the heart. Now, given all these forces, it should be no surprise that things are messy in the heart. Unpredictable, complicated, confusing. Often in the heart, we don't have words for all that we know. The heart is the place where, though we may not be able to explain it exactly, we get intuitively Walt Whitman's declaration, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then. I am large. I contain multitudes." A healthy heart lives like this, holding contradictions, tending and mending to the mess of life rather than fleeing or fighting. And on the other hand, a brittle, unhealthy, shut-off heart makes no such space, seeks instead resolution, finality, quick fixes, clear categories of right and wrong, good and evil, predictability, singularity. All of our hearts live somewhere on this spectrum of health, often at different places of throughout our lives as we struggle and grieve, learn, love, rejoice, and begin again. Parker Palmer reminds us that depending on our heart health, stress can show up in our lives either in the negative ways that inspire therapists to invent new terms of disorder. We would call this distress. Or stress could also be experienced positively, what's called eustress, an experience of stress that is beneficial, stress that is a source of creativity and life-giving generativity. Because, you know, stress and complexity, they turn out those are realities of living. We need hearts that will help us turn distress into eustress. And as Parker says, turn suffering into community, conflict into the energy of creativity, and tension into an opening toward the common good. Now, despite what we may believe or have been trained to believe, this sort of change or alchemy does not come by way of well-stated arguments of reason and analysis. Reason and facts are good. I agree with you on that. But they are insufficient. You might have experienced this in a comments string somewhere along the line. As Margaret Wheatley says it, neither I nor the world changes from my well-reasoned, passionately presented arguments. Things change when I've created just the slightest movement towards wholeness, moving closer to another through my patient, willing listening. Which means that we can't read or repost more articles or study more theories or listen to more talk radio to restore our democracy or our common life. Not even debate or discussion or a thorough compliance with Robert's Rules of Orders will get us there. To heal the heart of democracy, democracy needs us to heal our hearts. And Parker offers us many different ways to improve our heart health, a variety of habits to take up, like exercises for that greater understanding of the heart. At the end of November and early December, we'll offer a couple of Wednesday evening classes to explore all of his ideas more fully and consider how we'll engage them in our church and our lives. But for today, I want to turn to what he calls the two main habits of the heart required for a healthy democracy: chutzpah and humility. Out loud, they have a nice alliteration on the page. They don't, but once I started to say it out loud, I go, oh, I get it. Chutzpah and humility. These two seemingly contradictory postures that remind me, actually, of the promises of Unitarian Universalism's first and seventh principles. The first habit, chutzpah, is like our first principle, as it affirms that each of our voices matters, that each of us is worthy, inherently so, that our individual participation and engagement matters. We affirm this regularly in our faith, but internalizing it actually requires repetition, reinforcement, and embodied practices. After all, consumerism and much of our educational system often teach us to be passive audience members instead of engaged actors. And so we need to help each other and practice more often in places like this congregation. Practice being active participants whose voice and engagement makes a difference. We need to remember what it means to be an active part of a we, rather than feeling at the whims of the nameless, faceless them. Our fifth principle is not just a promise of how we will run meetings or a commitment to vote each November, but rather a promise that we will actively participate in our shared life, show up, listen in, and be a part. Through active, engaged participation, it remains possible for us, young and old alike, to find our voices, learn how to use them, and know the satisfaction that comes from contributing to positive change. The balance to this habit of chutzpah is the practice of humility, which is the natural outcome of our seventh principle, our affirmation of our interdependence, the reality that we are all in this life together, all interconnected, even interconnected with those who seem most alien to us, those who Parker calls the alien other. In life today, however, we are increasingly segregated from those alien others. And instead, we spend most, if not all, of our time with people like ourselves. And we invest our care and concern mostly for those closest to us, our immediate circle of family and friends. In reading Parker's book, I started to realize that critical to democracy is an awareness of the ways we need each other. Not just our siblings, spouses, parents. We need all of us. We all need all of us. Working against democracy is our myth of independence and self-reliance and our modern trend towards increasing privatization. Democracy requires an awareness of our vulnerability and our need for others beyond ourselves, beyond our family unit. Even our need for those whose lives and convictions run in direct contradictions to our own. An awareness of this and opportunities to actually practice it. For example, serving alongside people who are different than we are, learning skills to be better listeners and then actually listening to one another, tending to each other's suffering and joy. All of these practices foster a profound humility, reinforcing, as we say at the start of each of our services, that each of us holds but a piece of the truth. And these practices go further than tolerance, even beyond hospitality for the stranger. Instead, they ask us to receive the tensions of our differences as a gift. Just let it sink in for a second. To imagine that we would receive the tensions of our differences as a gift, where our hearts expand and are opened to a greater understanding of ourselves and our world. It is here that the heart's alchemy can keep doing its work. One of my teachers in seminary was very fortunate to have the great Dr. Vincent Harding as a professor in my seminary. He was a speechwriter and friend to Martin Luther King Jr. Like Grace Lee Boggs, Dr. Harding often called us to remember that global sense of time. even though he pressed a fierce urgency of now, his tender speech and his way of listening reminded us that behind the marching and protesting, debating and politicking, were real human lives, real stories that play out in neighborhoods and schoolyards, in grocery stores and around the kitchen table. He would say, when it comes to creating a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, truly democratic society, we are still a developing nation. We have a lot of pain and a lot of hurt. We've got to do this together. Listen better. Hold each other. Tend and mend these deep stories that we carry. He'd say, America is trying to give birth to a new story, and we're just beginning. It is such a hopeful imagination that he offers, such a profound and helpful way to consider this moment that we're in, that we are experiencing labor pains, this terrifying, sometimes dangerous, chaotic labor pains of America trying finally to be born, finally making good on our promise of liberty and justice for all. If we can step back from the news cycle, from pundits and politics, I think we know he's right. We are in the midst of a great change, a great turning, and a new birth. On the clock of the world, it's dark because dawn is coming and day's about to break. Now is not the time to check out, but to wake up. Now is not the time to respond to bitterness by becoming more bitter, but to allow what is breaking us, what is broken, to break us more wide open, that we might be more alive, more flexible, with hearts held with so much space and tenderness and humility, partnering with all the grace and love of our vast universe, that we might hold even more complexity, more contradiction, more compassion, and more hope. As if midwives of a new age, this breaking dawn and emerging story need us to keep whispering to one another, to ourselves, and to this great struggling and beautiful world, you can do this. I'm here with you. Don't turn away from the pain. You are doing this. Keep going. You're not alone.